You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you're going to hear an interview with Greg Delante, local poet and St. Michael's College professor. Greg Delante was born in Cork, Ireland, in 1958, and lived there until 1986. He became a U.S. citizen in 1992 and retains his Irish citizenship as well. He now lives most of the year in Vermont, where he teaches at St. Mike's, as I said, and returns to his Irish home in County Kerry each summer. Delante has received numerous awards, including the Patrick Kavanagh Award, the Alan Dowling Poetry Fellowship, the Austin Clark Centenary Poetry Award, and a Guggenheim Fellowship for Poetry. He has received an Irish Arts Council bursary, and his poetry has been widely anthologized. Delante is a past president of the Association of Literary Scholars, Critics, and Writers. I interviewed him at his home in Burlington last week, and we began by talking in general terms about poetry, but also sort of where poetry fits into his life.
Poems are my life, you know, they're everything. They have been everything to me since I was 17, and I read every day, and I have to read every day and find nourishment out of the poems,
right.
Other people's poems, I mean. Usually I find around seven, while meditating on them even, and just trying to kind of calm down. I've been kind of a little lunatic in recent times. Just trying to do too much, etc., just calming quality. Like, but I love the, you know, so I find seven poems. I'm compulsive as well. I kind of have try and keep my own routine. I get up in the morning, I read for a few hours, have my breakfast, read for a few hours, and then who knows what's going to happen in the afternoon. You know, I'm in a chores, or I might write.
So you don't write at a regular time of day?
No.
It's up to whenever you feel it?
No, I used to one time, when I started writing poems earlier on, a lot of the first two or three books were often not poems that I wrote immediately, you know, that they weren't written down. But I tried to break that after maybe the third or fourth book after American Wake, because it was getting too staid, it was getting too boring and predictable. So at the time, actually, I couldn't do it. It was a hard thing. I wanted to try and write instant poems, you know,
mm-hmm.
or poems that seemed instant. Of course, the other poems should have seemed instant as well, but it just seemed too much of a formula for me, and I needed to break out of it. And I also wanted to break a writing style as well and find something new, you know.
Right. Yeah. So it sounds like you need to read every day, but do you write every day?
Oh, God, no.
You said in the preface of Loose Strife, you say, art and life are not separate the way people talk of it. I think of art and life more as a kind of palindrome, which is what you're just saying. So so I was wondering, you know, you talk about causes being important to you, and you participate in demonstrations. So what causes are most important to you?
I don't think of life in the way that we tend to think of it as being political and private, you know. The causes that are important, me are the causes that are important to everybody, like love and friends and just being alive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just having a cup of tea, like, they're the causes, but then there happen to be other ones as well then, like how we're destroying the planet, you know, that I try and play my part in a way that I feel that I'm trying to do something that, rather than being an ivory tower, you know, or being apathetic, trying to cause less damage than more damage in all the various ways that we live, you know, not
mm-hmm.
just, I think, in our personal relationships, but also in our public relationships, you know. So, I mean, I have been very active in recent years. Lots of things over the years earlier on. It was more when we were in Ireland, it was nuclear weapons, except, you know, all the things of the 70s, I suppose, 60s and 70s. I also worked with the homeless for about 4 or 5 years in our version of the cots in Cork, you know, quite a lot. I was always active in general things that I thought were wrong, say anti-war or whatever. I mean, I don't want to come across also, though, as a beatnik, as somebody who is just a rabble-rouser or something. Not a rabble-rouser, but, you know, that is against everything. I'm for most people, most things and most people, even people who I don't think are... Well, might be doing terrible things, you know what I mean? I try to think of them in a different way, you know, in the way that they're not. I mean, I'll try to love you if you're a Republican, even.
Even that.
Even a Democrat, Christ. At the present, in recent years, it's been more to do with the environment, because I think that's probably the most fundamental and largest, if not, you know, there's no comparison compared to all the other issues, is how we're really destroying the planet, and that there's a good possibility that it's just a matter of how bad it's going to be for our children and children's children and later on, and how we're going to change the climate and make it a planet that more or less will be much harder to live in. So I'm just trying to make it a little less by being part as a simple regular human being, among other regular human beings, you know,
right.
Trying to do my thing, really. I could do more too, you know. And at the moment, I'm involved in the F-35 things. They're having a talk at St. Michael's, an open talk for everybody, for for and against. I'm against them. I'm against the F-16s. I think they're... You'll see there's some of the poems there about it. I've never liked them. I thought the dichotomy between these dreadful, lethal killing machines flying over, who are also in recent times killing innocent people in other countries, in places where the US shouldn't be, and I'm a US citizen, so I'm entitled to say that. I think it's terrible. I think it's a terrible contrast. I think it's a terrible dichotomy to see them flying over there and kids playing around and nobody taking much notice of these killing machines. But mainly I am most interested in recent years with the environment and the 350 group, which I work with, and Bill McKibben. We work together. I mean, I know Bill, and we're and David Stemper, who's probably the main organizer now here in Vermont. So I try and help them as much as I can and be part of all that, and that is therefore part that I have a legitimacy both ways in my life then to write the poems I want to write.
Talking about the jets reminds me of one of your poems that I was going to ask you to read, so I wonder if maybe now would be a good time to ask you to read the poem Us.
Sure. US. The snow cap of Mount Discovery is like a white hanky, the knots tied in four corners on the shiny dome of a bald man at a blistering All-Ireland final. No one here knows what hurling is, a game played by the gods, when they deign to come down and enter the human body. Ares, that most unpopular of commanders in chief, even among his peers, has made this country his own. Two fighter jets on display scissors the sky's blue cloth to shreds. They fly above our house in pastoral Vermont. People nearby cheer. We are far from home. There is another part, there's a few different partner poems to that. Awake on Lake Champlain, which when I came here first, I was down by the lake, and I was my first few days, you know, and all of a sudden one of these things flew over. It was kind of shocking to me, in the contrast of such a rural part of Vermont, a beautiful part of Vermont, you know, across the New York mountains, and somebody just said to me that it was from, the man said to me Plattsburgh nuclear base, but it wasn't actually a nuclear base at the time. It was during the first, oil crisis, where the Bush the father was the president, and he sent troops to Iraq.
The first time around.
And I didn't support that, and I was active in not supporting that. Nonetheless, this is the poem. Awake on Lake Champlain. As an F-16 unzips the sky, a white-sailed yacht races in like a surrendering rider from the plain of the lake, and a boy conjures doves with a piece of cake. Gas pumps plug their fingers to their ears. You can hardly hear a child start to cry. Her father fails to rock her still. Afterwards, he remarks, this jet guards Plattsburgh nuclear base or is on border drill. Now, she's mesmerized by a duck and drake teaching oblivious fledglings how to play follow the leader. A peace sign spreads in their wake.
Thank you, that's great. The first poem you said is it U.S.? It's not us. Is it U.S.?
That's up to yourself.
Okay. All right. I like that. So you've lived in Vermont at least part-time for 25 years.
No, you could say I live here full-time. I mean, I just go back to Ireland for a few months every year.
Okay. And at this point, how often do you think you have that sense of being far from home in your daily life? You know, that last line in that poem.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the poems, especially in the early books, have to do with being an emigrant and immigrant and being far from home or the place I originally grew up in. But then again, that's just a metaphor for us all, aren't you? Do you feel at home all the time in yourself? Do you?
No, sure, not.
You know, I don't anyway. So it's just a metaphor for all of us, really. You know, the particulars in everybody are different, but generally people underneath the skin of that difference are more or less the same. You know, they have the same old problems.
Yeah.
They worry about this or that. They worry about what shoelaces they'll put on this morning, or they'll worry about brother or a sister or going to the baseball match, you know. But we're all the same. It's just that the predictors are different in general, and also the same as everything perhaps around us, much more the same than different. I think that in literature itself, art, but specifically for me, for poetry, it breaks the skin of difference that we all the time categorize people being different. You're a woman, I'm a man, you know, I'm Irish, you're US, you know, he's black, he's white, he's a student, I'm a professor. And we categorize all the time with the differences, and that causes a lot of problems, and it's only surface difference, and we can't see the sameness behind, which is much larger and more substantial. And literature, in a certain sense, does that. You know, you could do a poem by W.B. Yeats in the 19th century. He writes about his love life, you know, and doing that with the students at the moment. And they see that their own life is exactly the same, you know. The lover says, you know, basically the lover says at the end of the poem, take it easy, don't be getting so serious, you know, which the students have heard from one girl or guy, you know. So they discover it's all the sameness of everything, even though the pictures, the language is different and the people seem different and the times seem different, they're not really.
Mm-hmm.
And so that literature and art itself breaks down the skin of difference that we all seem to seem into a more generalized sameness and therefore a connection with everything around us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Let's talk a little bit about your book, The New Citizen Army.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
No, the Loosestrife. Loosestrife comes after New Citizen Army. You know, I just want to put a group of political, over the years, poems that I've been writing that happened to be turned out public political poems rather than love poems or whatever. Though I did include, say, a poem, The Alien, which I'll read in a sec,
yeah,
about my
that.
Child, you know, who's coming into the world as an alien. And we are all kind of aliens, really. One of the most unusual things that human beings do is that they think this is all normal. We're actually on a ball, spinning sideways around a ball of fire at thousands of miles per hour, both of them spinning, and we're going through blackness or whatever, you know, and we don't know where we're going, and we're on a kind of a big ride, you know, and we think if we were on another planet that'd be strange, but we are on a strange planet already. We just happen to live here and breathe here, but though we're destroying that as well. So I mean, Dan is an alien, we're all aliens, and of course we're all not at home on perhaps as human beings all the time or most of the time. So that's where that poem comes from. But in general, the book is more overtly a political book. And I wanted to be able to say that in poems. A lot of people think that maybe perhaps it's not a good idea to write a book of political poems, that it's that you're on a bandwagon, you know, and that poems can't do that and they don't have a right to do that. But if they come out naturally, I think they're very much part of one's personal response to the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I can go on the bandwagon when I go on demonstrations, or when I just talk to a politician, say, and I talk to Senator Leahy and say, or Bernie Sanders, and I say, I don't agree with this, or I do agree with this, and thank you. You know, but the poems are just a natural reaction to everything around me, really.
Mm-hmm.
But they are overt. And it is also the idea that what Auden says, that poetry makes nothing happen, he says, you know, in a poem. And I don't believe that's true. I mean, it's literally not true, because it did make something. He says it in a poem, The Death of Yeats. It's one of the great elegies of the 20th century, on the death of W.B. Yeats. And he says in it, poetry makes nothing happen. But it did, literally, because it gave a job to the printer to print the book that that poem was in. You know, he made his income out of that, and he brought home and made, they got the food home. You know, literally, and somebody cut down the tree to make the paper for the book.
Right.
So literally, it does make something happen.
Yeah.
And we don't know what happens when a poem goes out into the world. But sometimes there are evidences in my life that it seems to have changed people and things in ways that have been much better that they happen than not. For instance, I did a poem by Wanda Coleman and it was called Rape. It's about a woman being raped on numerous occasions. A very complicated, complex poem, nightmarish poem. And I remember I did it maybe 15, 20 years ago in class. And
you taught it?
Yeah. And then maybe a few years later, female student, stopped. I'd forgotten even. I thought to her, I mean, I knew her, but I didn't. Just said hello. And she stopped me in the quad and I said, oh, what have I done? And she said, because she seemed very serious, and she said, I want to tell you this. I was raped. And she had told no one till she read that poem. And it said, she had sought help. And it made her life so much better. But not alone that, did she started a rape crisis centre somewhere, I think in St. Michael's, I'm not certain. Right, so that spread out, that difference that poem made, that we did in the class,
yeah,
to make people's lives physically better and make her life so much better, that she was hiding this thing, she was embarrassed, she was mortified, or she was, the various terrible reactions that people have, women have when they're raped.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another evidence that poetry makes something happen. We don't know. I mean, it is just simply words put together in the most accurate way, in a renewing way, because all art renews. That's what it does. It makes the world, see the world anew.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you want to read The Alien?
Yeah, please. It gave me an entrance, actually, into the world of the mystery of the ineffableness of being alive. I mean, a child coming to, where does it come from? Where does it get its soul? Does it have a soul? Is there such a thing as a spirit? You begin to wonder about those when you see the child forming, and then you take in the religious aspects of one's life. And I'm a non-believer, though I remain open. I won't even categorize myself as agnostic, because any categorization seems to me to be wrong. But I do love in general being alive, though sometimes I get very down and I suffer from depression sometimes, like anybody else, I suppose, or like most other people. But this book allowed me an entry into a world, an articulated world, because of the child, the mystery of the child, the strangeness of the child. Of course, it's your own child, you know what I mean? So it's kind of fabulous, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually comes after two other books, The Hell Box, which is a book centred around men. And my father was a compositor. He set type with his hands. And then the second book was about my mother and women. It's called The Blind Stitch, was set in the sewing world. And then this is the child book. So it's kind of like a trilogy of, but not purposely, but I do think of it like that now, as opening up the three worlds. This is the world to a child. The alien, I mean, all these terms, gravitons and gravitons, they're all real. I mean, everything is real in this. Also, when I was looking for the forms, how these poems would look, feel, at the earlier on stage of the books, you get a note, you get a note, and it tends to follow through a book. If you listen to, say, some great songwriters, there's not many, but say Bob Dylan, who is, I think, the greatest artist alive, because he's changed so much, and he's broken a lot of barriers, and he's changed with every album, with new one coming out now, this month would be fabulous. There's a new note. So the note I found was from the 17th century religious poets like Herbert and Vaughan and those people, because they were talking religiously, and I am religious here in the sense of being this is a religious experience in a way, even though I'm a non-believer, secular, trying to figure out all these notions that we've always part of our everyday thinking. How are your spirits today? I asked the students, and they said they're great. But I said, have you ever seen your spirit? And then that's what the artist does. He physicalizes the spirit then,
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so it gave me a chance to think of all those things.
Mm-hmm.
The alien. I'm back again scrutinizing the Milky Way of your ultrasound. scanning the dark matter, the nothingness. That now, the heads say, is chock-a-block with quarks and squarks, gravitons and gravitini, photons and photinos. Or sprout, who art there inside the spacecraft of your ma, the time capsule of this printout, hurling and whirling towards us. It's all daft on this earth, or alien, who art in the heavens, or Martian, or little green man. We're anxious to make contact, to ask questions about the heavendom you hail from, to discuss the whole shebang of the beginning and end, the pre-Big Bang on time, before you forget the why and lie of thy first place. And, our friend, to say welcome, that we mean no harm, we die for you even, that we pray you're not here to subdue us, that we put away our ray guns, missiles, attitude, and share our world with you, little big head, if only you stay.
Thanks for reading that. That was a fun one.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the form of that poem a little bit. Are you a formalist? Very.
No. I am none. I will not take part or be part of any group. I'm not a group person in regular life as such. But a writer, an artist, shouldn't. It's been a mistake for me, I think, to. Maybe it's not been a mistake for it, but I think as an artist myself personally, you learn as much as you can from what people have done before you. You gather that into you, whether it's formal or informal, whether it's experimental or traditional, and you transmit it and emit it back out of yourself where it's suitable for what you have to particularly say at a particular time. So I will use 17th century form or poets, but I'd also be using other things, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, no, I mean, there's also a few experimental poems in it, I suppose you could say. You know, even the Hellbox poems are upside down and back to front, you know, you have to look in the mirror and upside down, because that's where they set the type. A printer could read the type upside down and back to front.
Okay.
And that, my father, who I love, he was a lovely man. I miss him most days, really, I think, and that's 25 years ago. He was a compositor, and the book called The Hellboxes. The Hellboxes where they used to throw broken and worn type, and then it'd be melted down and recast. A metaphor for our lives, and I said we all have to remake ourselves a bit, don't we?
Right, yeah.
But also for the melting pot of America as an immigrant, and also just to remake words, because now I am remaking them in my own way, from my father and the world that he grew up in. His father was a printer, typesetter as well.
Right.
And you're only adding for what you're trying to add from what people have done before you, you know. And also, of course, The Hellbox is a book about, loses a lot of the jargon from the printing world, like The Hellbox, this receptacle, this box that people do. But a lot of these are gone, you know. I mean, the language of printing, to the most part, is gone. And that in itself is about the mutability of us all. We'll all go, even the American country, you know, we'll all be. There won't be none, you know, there will be no sense. They'll all be gone sooner rather than later, perhaps. But, you know, so it's a book about mutability as well. But then also about things are connected. But I mean, you know, it's also even things are connected. I mean, even in the printing that starts off with, I should read one, but mind your P's and Q's, you know. Because the printer would set things upside down and back to front,
right.
P's and Q's would get very confusing for a printer. That's where that term comes from, mind your P's and Q's.
Sure.
You know?
That's great.
Can I read that poem from the first poem from The Hellbox?
Yes, please. Yeah.
And this poem originally came, I was feeling down. I couldn't find a new way of doing something, and I didn't know an entry. And I said, I was, remember at the time I envied Seamus Heaney in Ireland, and I envied other people like Montague and Kavanagh. And other poets who had a rural world that they wrote out of, and that became, broke from a literal world into a metaphorical world. When, say, Kavanagh talks about ploughing the field, he's actually talking about his life, not about ploughing, you know, I mean, he's talking about literally, but he's also talking about the metaphoricalness of it, you know. And I said, Christ, I'm only this guy from rural Cork City, you know, lived in a little rural suburb right on the outskirts of the city,
mm-hmm.
you know, just a... where am I going to get something? And then, you know, I'd love, they're lucky to have that kind of background to use in their poems to make something else out of, you know, to use metaphorically or whatever. And then I was inside in the printing shop, and I had a kind of Proustian moment where the smell of the ink, I was inside the ink shop in St. Michael's, and the smell of the ink set me going. This is exactly the same smell as now as it was then, and then I started the lingo, and then one poem led to another, and then I got a whole book out of it, you know, and it was an important book for me, really.
Right.
It's probably my, it's the first of books that I'm happy with.
Okay.
That is as an overall book. The Compositor. Perhaps it's the smell of printing ink sets me off out of memory's jumbled font. Or maybe it's the printer's lingo, as he relates how phrases came about. How, for instance, mind your P's and Q's has as much to do with pints and quarts as the printer's renown for drink, as it has to do with those descenders. But I don't say anything about how I discovered where widows and orphans and out of sorts came from the day my father unnoticed and unexpectedly set 30 on the bottom of his compositor's page and left me mystified about the origins of that end, how to measure a line gauge, and how, since he was first to go, he slowly and without a word turned from himself into everyone as we turn into that last zero before finally passing on to the Stone Man. So, you know, that you can see all that the Stone Man was a person who set the type in the end and etc. So it's all a kind of...
why is the 30 at the bottom?
We've never... I asked a journalist, etc., and nobody knows why people said 30 in the bottom. I forgot all the other things, but not that one. And, of course, we say out of sorts, but that's, the sort is an asterisk and all these little things that we put. And, you know, the printer's out of sorts. It's, oh, I'm out of sorts. And that's where we get the term out of sorts. You know, it's kind of fabulous, you know.
Yeah.
World language itself is fabulous. That's what the Hillbox is trying to do, too. I mean, by putting a poem upside down on the page, we think that's strange, but it's not strange. The language that we're looking at all the way it is strange, just as strange as it's been upside down and back to front. Right.
So now, actually, I want to ask you, because talking about the print shop and the setting type reminds me of, I've been in the Combat Paper Project office in the Warrior Writers' Office, and they have typesetting machines
and stuff.
And that brings us back to the cover of the New Citizen Army, which is very interesting too.
Yeah.
Now, have you been in their shop? And
I have. Well, I went down to them, and they did the book. I mean,
it's a beautiful book.
Yeah, it was my way of showing how complicit we are in our lives. I mean, we can't do anything anymore without actually hurting something. We go out in our car, and the air going into the air is just, it's hurting the planet. It's sad, like in modern times, how complicit we are in almost everything that we do. So you try and minimize that as best you can. But then that we were involved in a war, that we were killing innocent people, and we were paying our tax monies to, and, you know, our money, our own money, you know, to go to kill a child. I mean, I don't feel, you know, how do you feel? I mean, you know, I mean, wars are not good. I mean, we've somehow acclimatized to them in the West, but... and somehow, you're a wimp if you say it, you know, you're a pacifist.
Mm.
You know, I probably am not a pacifist. If somebody came and attacked me, I would hit back, you know what I mean? That would be in the street, but in general, I think it's a very bad idea, you know? But I think that the most wars now, and given that the kind of the West and specifically the United States is depending so much upon the... the military economy, you know, the money world of making weapons and sending weapons around the rest of the world, and the military industrial complex, that it's very hard now to get out of it, because it supports war and wants war to keep the economy alive, you know. So we've kind of brainwashed ourselves, I think, really, into this thinking that this is fine. Anyway, so it was my way of going down, and I wanted to say that I don't think of myself as being much different to anybody else, you know what I mean? So I wanted I think of myself as a citizen army. There's a poem called The New Citizen Army in it. Like them, they went out and they did kill people, and some of them did some terrible things, and they feel it, and they're not well in themselves since some of them got back, you know what I mean? They were young fellas, kids, didn't really know what they were getting into, and etc. So I asked them to make the book for me, and they pulped the uniform. They were pulping uniforms and making prints and sculptures out of them, and they're all together, the combat paper project. And I asked them, would they make the book for me? Would they make the cover at least out of US military uniforms? So the actual covers are pulped from paper from US military, which in itself is an artistic statement of remaking something again, hopefully making something better out of it. It's very minor, no doubt, but at least it's a way of making things better, and who knows how that will spread out in the rest of the world. It's a statement in itself, an artistic piece of work, you know, that you're holding the thing that it's actually saying you are.
Yeah.
The uniform that the man made, he might be dead now, he might have been shot, is typed on the cover of the book.
Yeah.
So it's literally what it is.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's another way of countering that Auden statement.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, certainly.
And it's great for my life as well. I don't want to feel useless. I mean, it's terrible to... It's a terrible time for everybody, students and young people especially, feel worthless. I mean, I'm doing this for myself more than anybody else, in fact, for myself. So I can be alive in the world, so I can enjoy my glass of wine and my beer at night time. So I can feel a little bit better about being alive, you know. So I can feel somehow that I'm adding, that I'm not that I'm trying to change things, that I'm trying to be better rather than worse. I could do more. I mean, I could sometimes, I have done civil disobedience. I have got arrested outside the White House with Bill McKibben and stuff. But I'd like to do more of that, but only if it's worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing much we can do, because even now, civil disobedience is acclimatized. The politicians don't really listen to us anymore, even though they say they do. They obviously are not.
Mm-hmm.
So, kind of stymied, really. You know, so this is my way of doing it for myself. It may be no good, and it may be do nothing, but it's doing so. It's at least me making an effort, you know.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and in myself, then at least I feel I'm doing something.
Yeah.
And I bit to face the world a bit better, and be in the world a bit better, and enjoy my glass of wine a bit better at night time,
yeah.
And maybe have a little bit more relief in myself about being alive as a human being.
Mm-hmm. Participation.
Something like that.
I want to talk about the new book that's coming out, the Greek Anthology, book 17.
The great book.
Big book.
It is a big book.
A lot going on. Can we just start by talking about how you came to write it? It's a very different book. It's fun.
It is. It's very unusual to have, you know, Clarknet and the Oxford series is kind of it's a prestigious publisher and main publishers in British Isles, Europe,
yeah.
And Ireland. And here too, I mean, but you know, it's not an American publisher. But then I had my collected. I was very young. I was in 50 before I had my collected. You know, and it's young. You know, you normally don't have your collected till later on, or you're dead. And when they when they wanted to have it, I said, like, do you know something I don't? You know, I mean, am I dying? Am I going to be killed off? And I didn't want it. You know, I think that I think they wanted really to do the collected so they get all the books together. You know. And just wouldn't have to deal with them anymore separately. But it was a real good thing for me in certain ways. But in another way, it created a situation where some people said to me, you're too young to have a collected, you know what I mean? I remember Hirsch, who ran the Guggenheim World. You know, I was too young. I mean, they're just poems.
Well,
they're
was
just,
there some drawback to doing it?
There was, because people, I didn't do it, but some people it irritated that I should have a collected, you know, so young. But I did put in the cover collected poems 1986 2006,
right.
So then they are collected, they're not selected, you know. I mean, there could be a term brought out now, selected poems, you know, somewhere in between a selected and a collected, or a complete or collected. But I did take out poems from early books and stuff, and I did rewrite some of the poems, and so there they are. But then you know, what am I going to do next? You know, I'm dead, so let's try. And some people felt, you know, you have to do something big after a collected. So, but I didn't care. I didn't let people say what they want to say. I just do another book, you know.
Yeah.
But as it happened, I had been writing this book for the last 10 years, since about 2002, maybe, I don't know. These poems I had been reading and doing a few translations of, from the Greek anthology book 1 to 16. And these are poems, little short poems, epigrams mostly, written about everything, about the child, about pottery, about every little thing everything. Possible, sex to death, to anything minor, like to somebody being cross with somebody, to a boat sailing out, to playing, you know, playing snakes and ladders. I mean, it's a Greek game, by the way. You know, so...
Do you speak Greek?
No, no.
Do you understand?
No. I was just translating from the Loeb, and I'd help. I had a great friend who died around that time, who actually originally put me on to Catherine Washburn, who did the Norton Book of World Poetry. And she had been translating them herself, and she put me on. I just started looking at him and helping her, you know. And I started writing poems, and I think it was in Ireland, in Kerry. I have a little hut down from the house. And I said, geez, that's a bit like a Greek anthology. But I took no notice, and I kept on writing them, you know. And then I started making up names. One name is Greg Riff Corcus, and I'm from Cork. But there was a Vermontis, I don't know. And there's sort of friends, a pair, and a lot of the poems are versions of my own name.
Yeah, there's Grigora Graphis.
Graphis means the writer. And there's a lot of writers. There's Heinius, you know, which is Seamus Heaney, who's a friend. And Seamus, in his new book, has a poem to Gregory of Carcass, literally in the new book.
What about Bilius the Laureate?
That's Billy Collins, our friend Billy, you know what I mean? So I'm putting in all of it for a laugh, you know? Right. But as I say, even now, people get a kick out of it. As I say, Seamus, in his new book, Human Chain, has a poem dedicated to Gregory of Carcass. You know, so it's funny, you know what I mean? It's good fun, you know. And it's also a way of including, also a way of connecting. But it's all these made-up poems that are pretending to be translations. It's also trying to open up 1,000 years. Mainly they were done between the year 600 BC and the 600 AD, approximately. And there were poems about war, about this and that, normal, ordinary things, about a piece of pottery, about nothing. But it also covers a zone where there was huge changes over 1,000 years of civilization, from the pagan to the Catholic, but it's also the Greek world is the founding world of our Western civilization. I mean, democracy, or language even, you know, lots of words are Greek, or artistic world that comes out of the Odyssey and the Iliad and the mythology, and our democratic world, and our governmental world, and even our buildings are built on Greek models in government, city hall, you know. So it seemed, also it was like there were wars, it talks about, it was nothings, and the death of one civilization over another, and it seemed very suitable for our times, which have kind of speeded up 1,000 years in 100 years, sort of, you know, we have fast-forwarded in what we're doing to the planet, so I could get in all that, you know, and made up the names, and even get in references to presidents and... Or, you know, there's one guy called Hegor Bush, which is kind of made up word. It was George Bush, if you look at it properly. Okay. You know, but you shouldn't see that first. You know, they should all appear as if they seem to be translations.
Well, and your preface is very tongue-in-cheek. Your preface is this is a book of translations.
Just newly found. You know what I mean? So, in a way, it's also kind of breaking down the idea of writing, you know. I mean, we're writing over the past anyway, all of us. And it's waves... breaking down the categories even of ideas of translation and poetry and translation and the real thing. Is there such a thing? Aren't we translating everything anyway? As we're doing, as we're here, I mean, you're translating me and I'm translating you as we just sit here. I mean, that's just obvious, but still, also translating the past with the future. We don't think ourselves the same as the past, but we are connected to the past and we are very much the same as the past. In more ways than we think, and maybe worse ways often, because we think ourselves superior. And mechanization of the 20th century and has pushed us forward in such ways that are so detrimental to us, because we can't catch up and spiritually in other ways. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, which the West is particularly bad at. The East have still kind of Buddhism and Hinduism and stuff are more healthy with regard to being connected to the rest of the planet. You know. The animals and plants, we've disconnected. Christianity is disconnected. It's my major gripe with the Christianity as a form of religion and being in the world, and I grew up a Catholic, but I'm a non-believer, is that it's not connected as much as it should be to the natural world. I mean, you don't have Christ talking too much about You know, being, you say Francis, like, but, you know, compared to Buddha or compared to the Hindus, who were very much part of the animal and plant kingdom and part of, or even Native American, some of the Native American things, they're more, or more pagan ones, are much more naturally in the, they see this as part, not as superior. Mm. And human beings in Christianity see themselves as superior. And that's what's disconnected us from the natural world. And that's why we're destroying it, because we think we're not part of it. Mm-hmm. Someone fooled ourselves. We're animals, just like anything else. I mean, like animals that will overtake, like an ant colony or will rats, or we'll overtake, and we'll overtake ourselves, of course, in the end. May I read a poem?
Yeah.
Loose Strife. You've become your name, Loose Strife. Spurting up out of ballast, a cure brought across the deep to treat wounds, soothe trouble. There have been others like you, the rhododendron, the cattails that you in your turn overrun. Voices praise your magenta spread, your ability to propagate by seed, by stem, by root, and how you adjust to light, to soil, spreading your glory across the earth, even as you kill by boat, by air, by land, all before you. The hardy iris, the rare orchids, the spawning ground of fish. You'll overtake the earth and destroy even yourself. Ah, or Loose Strife, purple plague, beautiful us.
I read a little bit about that poem in addition to reading that poem, and I loved what you said about how the sonnet is imported from Europe as well as Loose Strife being imported from Europe.
Yeah, I mean, and as well as that, I mean, the sonnet was created, it was created in Italy as a love, well, pre-Petrarch, but Petrarch made it popular as a love poem, just as I said, my students are in love, they're all in love with somebody in Alior and the restaurant over there. Same thing, he just wrote a sequence of poems that he used that form and he made it popular.
Right.
But it becomes translated, used by the British Empire, by Raleigh's, great poets, Raleigh, Spencer, Wyatt, who in it themselves were in Ireland and killing natives, you know, mass killings, you know. So this thing physically made by man, created, which was brought into the English language by Raleigh Spencer, literally brought in translations from Petrarch, and then became, they discovered that it's a very good container, mould, for getting in short spaces of time, in a short space of 14 lines, in ink, a lot of information, a lot of power, emotionally and in content. And they wrote love, but it became, as it went on then, the religious poets started using it, and it became political poems, it started being used. But for me, it became also a symbol of that world of men in its form, that when I use it, of being complicit again, complicit of a structure. Structures themselves are structures of a larger way of society. Do you understand me?
Yeah.
So everything's connected, you know?
Yeah, and I love how that metaphor of the Loose Strife being this invader.
And it's the American son, as somebody called it. But yeah, it is. We are invaders, aren't we?
Yeah.
I sound like I'm being very anti-American. I'm not. I love being here. It's been very good to me. And yet I am very critical of, you know, what it's doing to the rest of the world and what it's doing to itself. And we could do much better, and the political system could do better. But then we have great things. I mean, we have Bob Dylan. We have a great life here. America has been great. It's done terrible things, but it's done great. I mean, it helped people in the Second World War. I mean, it is great culturally. I mean, everybody's trying to be American in Europe. Everybody wears denims, which comes, by the way, denims and the old usual 1960s stuff came from civil rights, came out from America that helped Europe. And of course, that came from the Beatports, from Ginsberg, and from the characters in the 50s who broke from the natural conservatism of McCarthyism in the 50s, and they started wearing, their reaction against suits, they started wearing denims, etc., normal working clothes, or workers' clothes, and then they become part of our makeup now. Students wear denims because of people like that in the 50s reacting against it, and they were writing poems. So there's a physicality of all that as well, you know, everything's connected, you know.
Yeah. I wonder if you want to read something from the new book.
Yeah. But this is the first poem of it, and it's by Gregor Grafes.
Okay.
You know who he is, eh? The first story. The email telling a friend, we're not too bad considering the state of the world. Crosses the Atlantic with the touch of a key. The leaves of an evergreen blow like a shoal of emerald fish returning to the same place. A cardinal in his scarlet robes pecks the feeder. The bells of the Angelus ring from St. Joseph's. The angel of the Lord declared unto Mary, the infant God of my childhood is back on earth again, the one I've ceased to believe in, the life belt that keeps believers afloat in the storm of being here, issuing tickets to the hereafter ever since that episode in the garden. The tall tale of our banishment concocted by some storyteller who'd be so flummoxed we've taken it for gospel, he'd say, look around you now. Behold the garden. And then a few other, like, I'd like to read just something that is not so political, you know.
I had fallout as one of mine.
Fallout. It's about an old friend of mine who we fell out, like, really, and sad, you know the way. Today I read a poet's elegy for his friend, written 40 years after he passed away. It hurt me to read how friendship still shone, a paradigm of friend love, the jewel in the crown of life. And I thought of you and wished I was that poet, and you had died in the good old days, and it was I wrote that poem to you, my friend, my sometime friend. So, this is in Muddy Waters Cafe.
Okay.
I'm just opening them at random.
Good. You know.
At a table in Muddy Waters Cafe. Who's the author? Who was the last one? Who's the author? Who's Zabo's author, I suppose we should say. It's Gregory of Corcus.
Okay.
At a table in Muddy Waters Cafe. You know, it's a reference to the three fates, Clotho, and they decide our lives in Greek mythology.
Okay.
Three women talk about their men, boyfriends, crushes. Each looks beautiful. One wears ponytails, and on her wrist, the tattoo of a star. Another has shower-wet hair, scented with hyacinth. The third one shows surely Clotho, without a glance at our handiwork. They take no notice of me at a nearby table. Invisible as a cab driver, my hair thinning. Clotho says of one view, I'm really not gone on him, he's too nice. Said in earnest, no irony intended. The others nod, don't laugh. I wish I had been privy to this conversation 30 years ago. I, who always fell over myself being nice to women I longed for, hardly ever ended up with. If only I'd known. That's another one. You can see, there were different things.
I love the poems that take place in a local venue that I'm familiar with.
You had
one from Woody's in Middlebury. Woody's has been gone a long time, but I used to go down there all the time.
Yeah. This is about old people, and I was in a diner, above the Lamoille River. It's by Rosanna Dedalus. That's the reference to Rosanna Warren. You know, Robert Ben Warren's, we're friends, and I was the president of the Association of British Scholars, and she was, and we're connected. But she actually published this poem in a book called Dedalus. You know, it's just having fun.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say this, you know. When the book comes out, I will not say who's who. And there's a lot of them, like Honest Me Don is a makeup of Honest Me Don, and my name is Daniel John Gregory. So there are versions of all sorts of things going on. You know what I mean? Anyway, in a diner above the Lamoille River, the rocks below on the river trail foam fins, as if they swim upstream along with the salmon, returning to their spawning grounds, leaping falls, freshets, whirlpools, the ancient anonymous struggle. the fish age instantly to mottled old-timers, dying in the nursing pools of their birth waters. A tour group of elderly are the only other diners, their skin mottled not unlike the salmon. They seem to get along. They jaw about the weather, the water height, the amount to tip. One woman's trembling hand fills the patron questionnaire with praise. I scribble this on the back of mine and tip the kind waitress a little more than usual. She laid their steaming bowls like a priestess setting her libation on the altar of trembling elder gods. And then I just finish up with one. The last poem, which kind of connects with the first poem with the behold at the end of it. The Traveller's Grace by Gregory Paraplemius. The Traveller's Grace. Nothing like landing in a foreign city early morning, preferably in weekday hubbub. Everyone going about their business, lost in themselves. Not a thought of how strange, foreign, alien their lives are. How abnormal to think it normal to find ourselves on a spinning ball, reeling around a star at thousands of miles per hour, from who knows where to who knows where. How outlandish. I'm one of the sacred dead, released from the underworld of the mundane, the banal. Behold the normal.
That's great.
That's it.
Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Yeah, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Greg Delanty. His mind works a million miles a minute. It's kind of fun to talk to him. You can learn more about his work at his teaching webpage, academics.smcvt.edu/gdelanty. I should say at this time, the views expressed are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WOMMLP, its management board, or any of its affiliates. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Greg Delanty. When his students come in on the first day of a new term, he often will ask them, "How are your spirits?" And they'll answer, "Great," or "Fine," or "Good," or "Bad," whatever. And then he'll ask them if they've ever seen their spirits. Where is your spirit, he'll ask. Is it in your toe? Is it in your ear? Or where? Is it in your chest? Generally, nobody has an answer. And then he starts to discuss spirit as an abstract term. Love and death and happiness and sadness are all abstract words for things that are, of course, much harder to pin down. And so in order to renew such a word or concept, an artist might physicalize it. As an example, Greg Delanty suggests that people read The Vacuum by Howard Nemiroff, in which a woman's soul is sucked up by the vacuum cleaner. So this week's prompt is to think in these terms about spirit or love or another hard-to-pin-down word or concept. Write about it in a poem and renew it by somehow physicalizing it. Good luck with this prompt, and tune in next week for another. Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you're a Facebook user, please like us. It's actually called Write the Book Radio Show. That's the name of the page on Facebook. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and also at writethebook.podbean.com. That's P-O-D-B-E-A-N. I never spell that, but that's how you spell it. That's for the free podcasts that are all archived. As always, if you have comments about the show, if you have news about book-related events in the local area, or if you have a writing prompt to suggest, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. Everything that you hear on The Radiator is thanks to volunteer work. And more information about getting involved at the station is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.